Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the first ever episode of Deuce Bags, a podcast dedicated exclusively to the sport of tennis. So let's just get the ball rolling. But before we do, let me just introduce my co-host who must be buzzing now with the result at the Cincinnati Masters. I present to you my co-host, Umara Naz. Hi, Umara.
Hi, Sri. How are you?
Doing good. So buzzing still?
Or I
it's
am.
Calmed down?
I am.
You are.
Yeah.
No wonder.
I can't deny that now. It's few and far between now for Roger Federer. So, you know, we have to enjoy them when they come.
Very rare, is it? I hope it doesn't become even more rarer, though, for the sport of tennis.
Well, he's getting older now, so we'll see. So, yeah, joining us today, we have an AI regular, host of one of my favorite pods, actually, the brilliant TTT podcast, all-round sports lover, the man with all the stats you could ever want. And if that wasn't impressive enough, he's a really nice guy too. That's Mr. Dan Rhodes. Hi, Dan.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, how are you?
That's a lovely thing to say. Yeah, I'm good.
Good.
Yeah, especially after the football last night. But this isn't a football pod. So let's get on to the tennis. Let's talk tennis.
One of my
first memories in sport is a tennis one. So
tell us, how did you get into tennis then?
Well, Just one name, really, Jeremy Bates. And I don't know how many people in the world of tennis can cite Jeremy Bates as the biggest influence or first influence. But one of the first things I can remember when my friends talking about an English player or a British player getting to the second round of Wimbledon. And it was on TV and it was big and the tennis was only on. I can only ever remember it being on every fortnight during Wimbledon. And Jeremy Bates beat Peter Fleming in the first round at Wimbledon, went on to reach the third round that year. And at the time, and what would become a ritual, no English player or British player would ever get to the second round. And never mind, you know, Henman came along and got to some semis. But that was the thing. No British player was ever likely or looked likely to win it. And one player getting to the third round of Wimbledon was considered a summer sporting success. So, yeah, Jeremy Bates.
Jeremy Bates, wow. Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to ask you what year that was.
87.
You're all right to tell us.
Yeah, and I was 7 at the time, so.
Okay.
And I ended up going down to the local courts as well the year after. Got my first racket, which was a Donnet. So, yeah, thanks, Jeremy Bates. I also served the volleyed as well, so that's all Jeremy Bates' fault.
Right, okay, I thought you were going to say Becker or no. Edberg or some big, huge name like that. But no, okay,
I learned to love Becker at the time and McEnroe, obviously. Yeah. McEnroe was the biggest character when you started to follow tennis. But no, it was definitely Jeremy Bates.
Right, okay.
What was
yours? All right, sure. Mine, my earliest memories were obviously Wimbledon as well. You know, like you said, they were the only tournaments that were on TV at the time. And Yeah, I mean, I think I remember being a huge Boris Becker fan, and I would get really upset when he lost to Edberg. He lost a couple of finals to him, didn't he? But yeah, I remember watching that. It was always on in my house. My parents always used to have sort of the big sporting events like the World Cups or the Wimbledons and things like that. So they were always, you know, on in my house. So I remember those. But yeah, that's how I got into it. And then Steffi Graf at the time. And I remember having a little bit of a rivalry with Gabriella Sabatini. I don't know if anyone remembers her. They were my early memories of tennis, and then, you know, sort of became interested in it from there, really. What about you, Sri?
Well, you have stated two names where I'm just going to go on the other side of the net, literally. So I started watching tennis thanks to my mom. She was interested in the sport of tennis. She was more used to watching the women's singles, though she used to follow Navratilova a lot. So I started actually watching women's tennis first, but during one of those breaks, they were showing highlights, and that was it. I was head over heels. Though I was a young guy, I was head over heels over Stefan Edberg. The ease of play in his game was something else. It was a sight to behold for me personally. So Stefan Edberg,
one of the best volleyers I've ever seen.
It's like the ball would make its way to the racket rather than him taking the racket to the ball. He knew he just had to just touch the ball, and that was the grace of his touch was what attracted me to Stefan Edberg. So that was it. Stefan Edberg all the way till date. It's only Stefan Edberg. That he's my sole influence in tennis.
Even these days, even with the current generation that we're
definitely. I haven't seen anyone as good as him in what he did.
Oh, that's a statement. We'll get onto that later.
It's funny for me, actually, because I was, like I said, I was a Boris Becker fan. And now the tables have turned, because Boris Becker is now Novak Djokovic's coach. And then Stefan Edberg, who regularly used to break my heart as a youngster, is now Federer's coach, who I'm a massive fan of. So how the tables turn, hey?
All the more reason for me now, then.
You never know quite how it's going to turn out. That's what I mean.
Yep. So, Dan, since you have already started about how you started following tennis and you named Jamie Bates, is he your all-time favorite player or is there someone else?
Absolutely not, no. If you're a fan of tennis, you're a fan of Jeremy Bates.
I'd be concerned if you did say that. No offence to Jeremy Bates, but, you know, there are greater players.
My favourite has been Andy Murray, especially... It was. I had a conversation with one of my best friends about Murray when he won the Junior US Open back in 2002, I think it was, or something. And we've just followed him since then. You know, it was nice to have a British player come through the youth rankings and be so good. And so many people were talking about him in the same breath as they were talking about Nadal, although Nadal started his professional career a little bit earlier. So I followed Murray throughout his career and been a massive fan throughout. Novak is my other favourite player, and I think he's the best tennis player of all time. Don't even think there's an argument about it. When I was younger, it was Agassi and Ivanisevic. I used to love Ivanisevic trying to beat Sampras, and Agassi trying to beat Sampras at Wimbledon, and rarely did, but you know, I like a bit of a maverick in tennis. So we'll come on to Nick Kyriakos there. Who are you off? You've said Edberg, and you've said Federer. You'd want to tell us why even more.
Edberg, and I've not stated my other favorite. I didn't want to say it in the opening segment. So it's Edberg, and since I already told I got into women's tennis first, it was Monica Seles for me. Just the decibel levels got me attracted, if not anything else initially. It was just someone who was very different, who I could listen to playing tennis rather than watch, literally. That was the case with Seles. But
she was wonderful coming back as well. She showed amazing character coming back from accident.
Actually, I stopped following tennis for a while after the accident happened on the court. It's not fair to call it an accident, actually. But still, so I was so upset that I stopped watching tennis for a while. And then when... The internet was very rare than here, so it was all newspaper. And when I first read the news that she's actually going to try and make an attempt to come back to the sport of tennis, I was like, nothing like it. So let me get... There was this lull in between where I didn't follow tennis. And once she came back, I was again full-time into tennis. So it's been Seles, and Edberg and now Federer. And with Edberg as the coach of Federer, it's like icing on the cake, literally. So Federer is someone I prefer watching because just for the ease in the manner in which he plays the game. Nothing seems too difficult. Nothing seems like effort to me. I wouldn't use the word effort when it comes to Federer. So that's what but I used to love Ivanisevic. My dad used to love Ivanisevic. He was like, his games are great to watch. It finishes fast. He'll just say, it's like 15 love, 13 love, 40 love game. That's it. He's like, he was very happy in watching Ivanisevic play.
So well, those were my young. Tennis skill in there, but it's the best serve I've ever seen.
Yeah, he had this weird service action first up, and then it's like, boom, 15 love. I'm like, how? My dad was like, how does it matter what the action is? See the end result.
He changed tennis a lot because they tried to make the balls heavier and the rackets less responsive just because he was dominating so much on with his serve. You know, it was so fast.
Another guy who I was really attracted to, but I'm really disappointed that his career panned out was, the way it panned out was Marat Safin. That US Open, when he just came onto the stage, I was like, okay, this is a guy. I thought initially like that with Filippos is also, but I thought that Marat Safin's game was like far more all-round compared to Filippos. So Marat Safin was a guy who I had high hopes from, but ultimately it didn't work out the way I thought it would. So what about you, Umara? I know it's Federer, but any other names you're going to throw out here?
Yeah, obviously you all know Roger Federer is number one for me. I actually really do like Novak Djokovic. I just warm to him somehow. I mean, characters like Rafael Nadal have never appealed to me, but Novak Djokovic he's really matured in the last couple of years, and I've actually really grown to like him. I think he's an amazing guy as well, brilliant player. Obviously we all know that, but yeah. So strangely enough, I see a lot of people, Federer fans, who don't like him very much, but I think, you know, respect where it's due, and the guy has made such an effort, and he's just turned his career around. In the ladies, I don't know if any of you, you know, might be a little surprised by this. I really, really like Petra Kvitova, but she is just so inconsistent that it's just horrible being a fan of hers. She can be brilliant one match and absolutely rubbish the next. But when she is on form, I just think she's unplayable. The Wimbledon final last year was an amazing match to watch. But yeah, she's my favorite lady.
She's one player who I would downright say, yes, if she's on form, she'll easily beat Serena. I actually think she can. Yeah.
She can, definitely.
Not if Serena's on top of a game. Nobody can.
No, I think Kvitova, it's like I said, her game's so high risk, and she plays, you know, hitting the lines and everything. But when she misses bad. She can
badly
a set 6-love and lose the next one 6-love. It's just ridiculous. But when she's on form, I think she's a brilliant player. Just wish she was.
I just think a high risk game, it means that she's going to have more love six games and love six sets than six love sets, because if it's so high risk,
yeah,
she needs to hit the lines, and it's millimeters whether you're hitting the lines all the time.
If she could find some kind of balance with it, I think she could be really, really good. But she
might just take out the best part of her game.
But game management, know when to go for the winner rather than looking to hit a winner every point. I think, you know, against Serena, you can't just. I think against Serena, it's not a bad tactic to go for the winner every time because you're not going to out rally her. But against some of the other players, I think she needs to. It's a game management that's the issue. She's got all the talent in the world and all the shots.
Mm-hmm, definitely. She's got the game.
Essentially, she needs to ensure the game is good that she reaches the stage to play Serena. She might get knocked out before.
True, exactly. Like I said, she could, you know, when she won Wimbledon the first time in 2011, everyone was saying she's going to dominate tennis and she's going to be the next number one player in the world. And then she just went away for a few months and didn't do anything.
Navratilova, in fact, had been talking about her for a year before, from then saying, watch out for Petra Kvitova.
Yeah, and you can understand why, but like you all just mentioned, she's just so inconsistent. She cannot keep any form up for any stretch of time to be able to do anything, really. She wins a tournament and then that's it. You know, we don't hear from her for a good few months after that. But yeah, I do really like her. If she could get her act together, she could be a brilliant player.
And Dan, except Djokovic, you have done any memorable games we are going to talk?
Yeah, I've got a few. One of my, apart from a few Sampras and Agassi ones, one of the first memories was the Graf-Novotna final. when the Votner Graf was
just collapsed.
Graf was an absolute massive favourite, huge favourite for this. Had been dominating the women's game for years and years, and then the Votner, she came back 6-1, and then she was up, and then she just, it was so heartbreaking.
Horrible to watch,
wasn't
it?
Yeah. Oh, it was terrible.
She cried on the royal shoulder.
it was sad to watch as well. And she came back and won it, didn't she? Didn't she come back and win it?
I think she, yeah, she did.
She won the doubles. She definitely did. But yeah, the Olympic final, that Murray won was a huge one in terms of following Murray. And then the best match I've ever seen was Novak versus Nadal in 2012, the final. It was the five hour 45 minutes. Just an incredible standard of tennis for such a long period of time. Although the 2008 Wimbledon final between Nadal and Federer again was amazing standard. Come from start to finish. Federer on top of his game, Nadal just outpowering him at the end, but it was just incredible. Federer should have probably won that one, really. But my most memorable and favourite is the 2012 US Open final that Murray won. I've been waiting something like 25 years for Britain to win. You know, we had Rozetsky pretending to try and win one. Henman came a few semi-finals, but when the first ever Grand Slam was the Murray final when he beat Djokovic. That was amazing. The Wimbledon one was obviously fantastic, but just winning that first Grand Slam was huge for me.
So, Umara, what about you? He's named a few of yours, I suppose. He's named a few of mine as well.
Yeah, you know, I had the Australian Open final, Djokovic and Volti, what was that, 2012? Yeah, 2012. And yeah, it was just ridiculous. I remember sitting there on my backside for literally the whole 6 hours and not moving. And I think I had something to do that day. And I was like, when is this match going to finish? And it was just you could see on their faces, they were spent, their legs had gone, but just how they were carrying on was insane. It was just an amazing, amazing final to watch. So yeah, that's one of my memorable. I obviously do have to have a Federer favorite as well, because then it just wouldn't be me without it. I've picked and Dan might not like this, but anyway, I've picked the French Open semi-final of 2011 when Djokovic was on the 43-match unbeaten streak, and I had no hope. I thought, oh no, Federer's not going to win this, but he did. He came back and he won and he ended that streak, and the drama in that match was brilliant as well. I mean, the crowd were just so behind Federer, and it was... They really wanted him to win, and you could tell by Novak's face that he was getting a bit upset, I think, at the crowd's reaction to, you know, all of Federer's winners, and whenever he would miss a shot, the crowd would, you know, really cheer. So yeah, I think that got under his skin a bit. And then there was all the drama of if it had gone to a fifth set, that they wouldn't have played, they would have had to stop and play the next day. But yeah, Federer finished it in four, and I remember screaming in my house at the time. So that's definitely one of my memorable matches.
That's a good shout for one of Federer's best as well. That's one of his best performances, because Djokovic was on fire that season.
He was. And like I said, I wasn't really expecting a win, but then to come out to win it as well was just brilliant for him and for his fans.
So if I could talk about the same topic. Funnily enough, Dan mentioned it, because the first ever final I ever watched, since I already told you, right? I started watching women's tennis first, was the Jana Novotna-Steffi Graf final. So my mom was supporting Steffi Graf, and I had no idea who both of them were then. So I was like, I don't know. But the way the match unfolded, though it was one of my earliest memories in tennis, I still remember it. That is one of the games. Another one of the games, though I won't call it memorable, but it was so unexpected, was the final, I think, 96, right? Richard Krajicek and Malivaj Washington. It was
I love it.
just two unknown names playing in the final of Wimbledon. Just imagine. It's something unimaginable for me, at least. Wimbledon isn't associated with such names. But I still remember Sampras got knocked out really early, I think, second round or something. And it was like if you had to literally have a random draw for the finals of the Wimbledon, these are the kind of two names you would draw. And Richard Krajicek, everyone will now remember.
Who beat Sampras that year? Was that when Federer burst on the scene, or was that later on?
No, that was 2001, I think. Yeah, one or 2002.
Yeah. Yeah. Did Krajicek beat Sampras then? Because I can't remember Sampras losing.
Yeah, time. He got knocked out in the second or the third round, I think. So that was one. At least in my whole family, we all enjoyed the one where Ivan Isevich won. That Pat Rafter was it, right?
Yeah, when he beat Hemman after they went off for rain in the semifinal. When Hemman was winning.
We were like, it was so topsy-turvy, and like the whole family was rooting for Ivan Isevich. Like at least for all the entertainment he's provided, he deserves one. Whether he's as good a player to win.
As well. It went to a Monday, the final.
Yep, it did. Because there was a rain stoppage, so that was one. And another one was the Federer-Roddick one, where Roddick was playing, I think he played his best tennis ever in the first set.
Is that the 2009 one?
8 or 9, I'm not sure. One of the 2 years. 2009, I think. And then they had a break.
8 was Nadal, yeah.
Yeah, 8 was Nadal. Yeah, since you mentioned Nadal, I'll not forget. That final actually was scheduled on the day I had freshers in my post-grad. So people were like literally drunk and dancing, and then I was sitting in the bar watching the game.
You got your priorities right, haven't you? Nice one.
Like, you are come for your freshers. This is your time to know your seniors. I'm like, I have 2 years to know my seniors. I don't have 2 years to watch this game. And it literally went for hours. So I refused to leave until the game got over. And people were just praying. They didn't care who won. They just wanted the match to end. And the match just kept going on and on and on. And people were like, then one guy was like, he said, you all carry on. I'll just wait with this guy and pick him up and come back. So that was, I still remember that final. This is the schedule on the day. It was my freshers during postgrad. So these are some of the matches I can recall at least now.
Any matches we'd rather forget? I don't know if we haven't forgotten already. The ones that maybe have broken our hearts a bit.
Yeah, I've got a few of them. The Hemman Isevich one.
Hemman.
Yeah, Hemman against Ivan Isevich in the semi when it rained.
Oh, right. Okay. Shree, you got any?
Because he definitely had a chance to beat Rafter.
Right, yeah.
But I wouldn't call anything which I would want to. If I would like to forget one match, it was the match where the Selous incident happened.
Yeah.
I think it was Maliva. I think she was playing that day. Magdalena Maliva. I'm not sure.
What tournament was it?
I have seen hundreds of tennis matches that I have forgotten.
I wouldn't blame you for that.
Well, mine, obviously, were the two semi-finals that Federer lost to Djokovic at match point in the US Open. I think I did cry in one of them. Yeah, moving swiftly on, hey? So we're going to move on to some of the topics that have been news recently, tennis-wise. Nick Kyrgios has been in the news a lot recently with the incident against Stan Wawrinka. So we wanted to talk about sportsmanship in tennis. So, Dan, if I can start with you, what are your thoughts on the whole situation and what do you think about sportsmanship in tennis?
Kyrgios, I can't say his name. He was I'm terrible at that. He was fine, wasn't he? $25,000 US dollar, Aussie dollars, and might have been US dollars actually, and had a 28-day fine suspension. He overstepped the mark massively. Absolutely terrible thing to say. No need to bring that into a tennis match. But I don't think we need to be. All the moralising that goes on with him is terrible as well. Some of the Australian tennis legends, some of the things they said about him after Wimbledon was horrific. So he's got a balance to find. But I want characters in tennis. McEnroe, Agassi, all characters, all didn't fit in with the establishment. And I want people like that. So I want people to challenge the boundaries, but he needs to find out what they are and soon, or else he's not going to last very long. In terms of sportsmanship, though, tennis has had some excellent. Can you remember the one in the Aussie Open this year when Nadal served and it was something like 6-5 in the fourth against Smitschek or something like that, and someone screamed from the crowd just as he went up for the toss for the first serve, and as this guy screams, Nadal puts it massively out, and the umpire says, "No, it's a second serve." And Smitschek just said, no, we'll play it again in the first serve. And Nadal praised him afterwards because it was 6-5, you know, and Nadal went on to win. So it can happen and should still be praised when it does happen. But because of all the technology these days, there's very little sportsmanship you can show in terms of calls or in terms of, you know, things like giving the serve back. That was the fans' fault.
I think you'll see in the French Open when, you know, when they see, because they don't use Hawkeye there, and they look at the mark on the line. So you see them sort of, you know, they rub it out. I mean, I know that the umpire can come down and have a quick look at that anyway, but it's, you know, it's nice to save the umpire the time and, you know, just, yeah, that was in and that's fine. So things like that are quite nice as well.
So on touching on this Nick Kyrgios incident, I think we all agree that it was way out of line. And it was also unfortunate it happened with one of the really good guys in sport, at least whom I really think is a good guy in Stan Wawrinka. I've seen him live a couple of times now in recent years. So it's unfortunate it happened to him. We need characters.
Where did you watch him?
We have a Chennai Open. He's the defending champion last couple of times. So it's the first tournament in the year, Jan
is
first
it
week.
Clay or hard court?
No. It's hard court.
Hard court. Smart. So
he starts the year here. And he considers it lucky because he started here and next week he won the Australian Open last year.
He was superb against Djokovic. Djokovic looked on fire again. Did a bit of a Federer there in the final.
Yep. So, I think it was way, and it's not the first time it's happened with Nick Kyrgios. He's had a couple of other small activities which has not come to notice. Now, I think with this incident, everything has been put together now and it's just been blown apart. But as Dan also said, with the advent of technology, with social media, any viral news just spreads like crazy and tends to get exaggerated. You don't even know what are the facts of the case and the decision has already been made usually. So that is one of the pitfalls of modern day technology and modern day reach of social media. So, but in this case, at least he stepped way, way beyond this line. I think the punishment was kind of, there are certain things you say on court and certain things you don't. And it was very clear. Sledging is on Australians. At least the cricket team is known for that. But this is a one-on-one sport. This is not a team sport we are talking. And we are talking about the personal aspects of a player, which is, I personally think, is not warranted at all on the court. Dan?
Exactly. Well, it's a personal, it's when it becomes really personal, especially like it did in that case, because these guys share locker rooms. They don't have their own locker room each. You know, they share the locker rooms. They sometimes share their travel, sometimes share their eating space pre and post tournaments or pre and post match. You know, it's one versus one on either the women's or the men's game, and there can't be personal attacks while you're playing a tennis match against the person you're playing. It's absolutely no need for it, and he should know that. It can be a character. He can rebel against the umpires, you know, the line judges, whatever. He's a coach, whatever. But he does not need to get personal about the person he's playing. He just needs to beat him.
Yeah, I agree with everything you just said. Like I said, it's the personal aspect of it that was the part that was the concerning issue here. But it's just not befitting of tennis, really, is it? I mean, we see it in cricket, we see it in football. Like you said, they're team sports and, you know, they're always swearing at each other and they get personal. But, you know, you don't really hear it on the microphones. You can hear everything in tennis. And you'll hear Serena Williams, Andy Murray, and maybe not Federer's and Nadal's, but, you know, they swear when they've missed a shot and things like that. But, yeah, just getting personal, that was the issue here.
Well, swearing's always got to, it's always about the context, isn't it? And the swearing at the frustration of missing a shot. He's not swearing at his opponent.
Yeah, that's
that,
right, yeah.
And you can teach, if kids hear that word when they're watching it on television, you can teach them that he's using that word within a context. And it's the context that is key. If you're swearing at somebody, then it's offensive. If you're swearing at yourself or in frustration, it's massively different. And you can, you know, they can learn from that. And I don't mind a sports person doing something that comes naturally to them as a reaction to missing a shot, or doing something that they expect themselves to execute, and coming up with, it's a natural reaction, so it shouldn't be diluted, so they're not even allowed to, so they've got to say, oh, damn, or, you know, they've got to have words imposed on them. You've got to understand that. But then there is a balance, and if it becomes constant throughout every game that Andy Murray played, it'd be disgraceful. But if it's a one-off, in an emotional reaction to something, I think it's acceptable and shouldn't be discouraged.
The swearing, like you said, is heat of the moment. But the thing with the Kyrgios situation was that he thought about that. And, You know, that was the worrying part. He did it on purpose. He'd actually thought about it and he thought, well, I'm going to say this now. And he'd picked his moment to say it when everything was quiet and, you know, everyone could hear him. So, you know, there's kind of a little bit nasty streak to him then, which is not nice to see. Like you said, you can't explain that to children. Well, you can, but then, you know, they'll look at it in a different way and they'll wonder, well, if he's doing it, maybe it's okay for me to do it. So it's difficult to, like you said, explain that to any youngsters watching.
Also, let's not forget the influence of crowd, at least in the sport of tennis. They massively turn against you if they think you're up to something nasty.
It's very common in the sport.
They expect certain standards. Like French Open is notoriously known for this. If they think you have indulged in some kind of a foul play or nasty play, they massively are against. Remember that Hingis incident, she was literally in tears.
Well, the French Open crowd will boo you even if if you go up to the umpire and say, no, that wasn't in, and that was, you know, simple things like that. So they're really quiet. they're not finicky. Very tolerant of those things anyway. Yeah. So, you know, it doesn't have to be anything nasty there. It can just be a player having a little moan at the umpire about a ball that might have been out.
But that's what I'm saying. The sport as it is known for fair play. The crowds expected, the audience expected, the commentators were also expecting. So this was like way out of blue in terms of nastiness. But
it's just high standard as well in tennis, isn't it? It's higher than maybe other sports. You know, you've got...
Indeed.
It just doesn't happen there. These things don't happen there.
So if we could just move on from one controversy to the other, at least on the ladies' side, we had this controversy of Caroline Wozniacki complaining that she was forced to play in the Rogers Cup without sufficient...
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
In practice. So, Dan, what's your take on it? You have heard about this issue. Do you have an opinion? What are your opening comments on this?
This is far more far more disgraceful than the Kyrgios incident, because this is reducing the standard for all the people that have paid to watch. Do you think that Wozniacki is coming? She's going to be fully fit. She's going to be on the top of a game. And it turns out that she loses because she's not practiced for a week because she's been injured and forced to play. And then the reasons why she had to play is because she would have lost, she would have had a huge fine, and she also gets no points in her ranking, which she would have had she, even if she's not turning up with a genuine injury. And they've obviously claimed that she's not had a genuine injury. So that not only are they disgracing her credibility, they're then forcing her to play. And if this is happening regularly and you're seeing first, second, third, fourth seeds going out in the first and second rounds, you're going to know why. It might not be that they deserve to lose to that person. It might just be that they're being forced to play to just keep up the ranking and not face fines. And if the standard of tennis, you know, I'd rather see two players fully fit playing rather than a third seed and a qualifier playing, and the qualifier wins because the other guy can't walk, or the other woman is is not fully fit, has torn a hamstring and has got it all strapped up, or whatever the incident, whatever the injury, if you've not had practice for a week, you're not going to play the tennis you're capable of.
When she says forced to play, I mean, is that because she thinks if I don't play, I'll get fined and I'll lose my points? Or what does she mean by forced to play? Because that's a bit...
She's going to get a fine, but why should you have a fine if you've just had a genuine injury? That's the, you know, it's kind of, she used the word forced, but I don't think she was.
Yeah, I think the words were a bit strong.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's to sustain her rankings at least towards the year end. I think that's what she means by forced to. If she needs to be in the reckoning, she's forced to play such tournaments because let's not forget Montreal is a Premier 5, so that's. What, the fourth category? There is the majors, world championship, then the premier mandatory, and then the premier 5. So that's the fourth category. They have 900 points up for grabs. So I think in terms of sustaining her points, I think she means forced to play is my opinion.
Yeah, because I can't think the fine would have been too much of an issue. These players are millionaires, so I don't think the fine would have been something that would have forced her to play. It must have been to do with the ranking points.
I think I'm just personally aggravated with her leanings towards football, though. Just because it happened to Wozniacki, I think I'm more pissed off than usual. But it's been happening for a while now, at least. And it's at least someone has taken a stand to... Because, see, now the problem is there are also this parallel issues of people being accused of tanking matches. And if half-fit players come on to play the game and they lose and we don't realize they are not actually fit... This tanking issue goes hand in hand. I mean, we don't know whether they were not fully fit or is the issue of tanking actually happening. I think that's a more of a worry. You stop trusting the game itself, and that on a higher level is my bigger worry.
Well, I was concerned that she mentioned the ranking points because I would assume that if she was injured, she wouldn't get any anyway. So I'm thinking that if you've got a genuine injury, then you get to keep the percentage of the ranking points that you managed to get in that tournament the last time you played it, and it's rolled over to your next season because it's done on a rolling basis, isn't it, the rankings? So I was a little bit shocked that she mentioned rankings, so there must be a reason for that. Or she's just moaning and it's not a huge money fine. But it does suggest that players are playing when they're not at their peak. And maybe that's part of tennis. You know, I was talking to a friend today about it, and he says, you know, the reason why he doesn't think Federer is going to win the US Open is because Federer was very good over a week and can sustain that in terms of his fitness. But over 2 weeks, he now struggles to get the best out of himself in the semi and the final. I think that's a fair point. Part of tennis is, you know, Murray recently beat Djokovic. Djokovic had a treatment in the semi-final quite heavily over the semi. Djokovic managed to get through, but he clearly wasn't fit. And then he comes and turns up against Murray in the final, who is fit. And then, so is it just a battle of fitness? Is it a battle of who's the strongest? And Nadal was clearly famous for that. So I'm concerned if Wozniacki is only 50% fit and she thinks she has to play for whatever reason. That shouldn't be fair. She should be able to say, look, I'm nowhere near capable of putting on a show here.
I think with the, these guys, they let WTA know well beforehand which tournaments they're playing. And then obviously then their ticket sales and everything depends on it. I mean, for example, somebody living in, Toronto, say for example, the tournament that she was on about, and if they're a huge Wozniacki fan, they would be rather upset that she pulled out. Now I know that obviously sometimes you can't control, but a lot of money rides on these things, and sort of from the fans' perspective, and I know that's not what the players want to hear, but then there's sort of kind of both sides to it as well.
But if I'm a fan of Wozniacki, I'd rather see Wozniacki at best rather than pale imitation. You
know? Yeah, no,
that's
I agree.
Be a lasting memory then.
Yeah, but it's just a lot. So much money is put into these things, and they use these, you know, their faces to sell tickets and things like that. So it's a big deal for them if it doesn't pan out as they want it. As much as we don't like to say it,
I think one more aspect to this issue, at least, is this issue like you are only allowed to pull out if it's a legitimate injury. Now, who decides what is legitimate? Becomes an issue. She had already lost the previous week in the first round or second round. She was clearly struggling. So I'm not sure why this isn't considered as a legitimate injury. So I'm not sure. Is that a gray area? I'm not sure. I'm not too well versed with the rules. Dan, you have any more info on this? Or Umara, you have info on this?
Did they actually say it was not a legitimate injury? I wasn't aware
of that. No, the rules state that you... If you are allowed to pull out if it's a legitimate injury. So I don't know what does that mean exactly.
Well, I wouldn't think an injury is anything else.
Well, she said she had a calf injury. But she also stated she was on it. She was hampered by it. So you would imagine there's got to be some level of assessment either by the WTA medical staff when she either arrives at the tournament. I don't know how that would work. But if she is, you know, assessed to have had a calf injury, then, you know, she must have decided that she's going to play. And it sounds like it's the pressure of rankings and fines that's been her motivation not to. But she also knows she's not 100% and you can't put a percentage on it, but she knew she weren't playing her best tennis. So again, it's a balance. I'm just concerned that if this is a trend, I'm not particularly bothered about Wozniacki. It's just more, is this a lot of players playing when they're absolutely nowhere near ready? And if you see qualifiers beating top seeds or second and third seeds, then I think you've got to see that that's the case because qualifiers have had a couple of matches before they get there as well. So their fitness is peak, whereas if players are being forced to play just to keep ranking points, then, you know, because you get quite a few ranking points for first and second rounds. So, you know, it's much better than zero as long as you just turn up.
Yeah, the Toronto has 900 points, as I mentioned. The premier mandatory one has 1,000 points for grabs, so it's not small points we are talking.
And if it is to do with the fines, I mean, I was reading up on this earlier, and correct me if I'm wrong, any of you guys, but if they fulfill their media obligations, then they don't get fined. So I think it must have been the ranking points that were the issue here.
Yeah, because she's made the most of her media appearances since.
Yeah, so I mean, even if she's injured, she could still do all the media stuff. So, you know, any parties or events or whatever it is that they do and where they need them to turn up and show their face. So apparently they don't get fined if they carry on with that, even if they don't play.
Maybe it was a bit of an excuse then. could well have been.
So let's assume the appetizers are done. So should we get on to the main course? The US Open preview. So, Dan, initial thoughts on US Open. Excited about it? How do you think it's going to pan out?
Always excited. Always enjoy the hard court season. How do I think it's going to pan out? I'd say if you're going to bet on it, your money should go on Federer. He's by far the best value. He's only third favourite. So you've got Andy Murray, second favourite. I don't think he can beat a peak Djokovic or a peak Federer at the moment. And then Nishikori is my outside bet. I think he's got an awesome game for the US Open. He knows it right to the back of his hand. He knows the conditions. His return and serve and range of shots is superb. So if you're going to ask me who I think is going to win it, I think Novak. If you're giving me a fiver to bet on it, I'd say Federer. And if you ask me who I want to win, it's Murray.
I'm surprised to be honest.
And I don't think there's a debate when it comes to the women's one. I think Serena's going to complete the Grand Slam.
Okay. Umara? So yeah, he's covered all his bases. So you're just going to say a lady is going to win the women's title?
No, I won't be that vague. But I agree with Dan. I think you can't really see past Djokovic. He's just the overwhelming favourite at the moment. Federer maybe, but then he needs things to sort of fall into place. So he's not the Federer of old anymore, unfortunately. Murray, I just think, is a little bit of mental frailty still there because he's got the game. You know, maybe some issues with his second serve and things like that. I sometimes do wonder if he's got it all right upstairs. I think sometimes that lets him down a little bit. He really, really gets upset with himself on court. You see that a lot. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure about him winning it. In the women, you can't argue with Serena Williams. I'd love somebody else. I do like Serena Williams, but it's getting a bit boring now. I would love somebody else to win it. Sharapova's another one, but she's injured at the moment. So we don't know where she stands right now. I had Nishikori and Vavrinka as my sort of underdog / outsiders to win it because Vavrinka's obviously shown us that he can. And for the ladies...
I think it's unfair you call him an outsider, though.
It is, but then you've got these amazing you know, Djokovic, Federer, Murray, people like that in front of him, you know, in another era, he would probably have been world number one. But, you know, it's just his bad luck that he's playing now. For the ladies, I'd love Halep to win it. I do really like her. I'd love, obviously, Kvitova to win it as well, but she'll probably go out in the first round, as we all know, to someone we've never heard of.
I think that's one of the things with women's tennis. You just can't predict, except Serena Williams winning it. You can't even predict her final opponent.
Yeah, Serena can beat herself, though. Serena can beat herself very easily. We've seen that.
I think it would be tightly contested.
Yeah, well, if she's out, then it's just anybody's tournament, really, isn't it? If she does go out to herself in whatever round.
Azarenka, I'd say, or Sharapova is very good at the US Open.
Sharapova. Yeah, I'm sure.
But you just keep hearing these new names every tournament. This new X, new Y. And there's just never a consistency like the men's game.
Yeah, it's difficult to predict. You know, I wonder what's going to happen when Serena Williams retires. And if she ever retires, it doesn't seem like she's retiring anytime soon. But, you know, who will? She's really not had a proper challenger for a long, long time now. Her sister was probably the last one, I think. And after that, it's been an easy, easy ride for her. Sharapova is the next, you know, sort of kind of best one around. And she's got a crazy winning record over her. So, you know, that shows you the gulf between the number one and the two in the world.
I think at least my favorite, at least from the men's side, is clearly Djokovic. I think if he just remains fit and doesn't get injured during the tournament, I think it's all good for him. I think that's my only worry, if he gets injured during the tournament. Because after he changes routine, I think his fitness levels is far supreme compared to anyone else. So I don't think anyone touching Djokovic if he remains fit. I think he's usually in Grand Slams, he brings his A game. So unless it's some superhuman effort, I can't look beyond Djokovic. Federer, I would be happy if he reaches the later rounds, at least the semifinal or final. But I'm just tipping Djokovic. And women's side, as I already told, I have no names other than Serena Williams to give, because I'm not sure who's going to turn up. But if I want to name a really rank outsider who has literally no chance of winning, but whom I think if he brings his A game over all the rounds, which I've never seen happen, is someone by the name of Milos Raonic. He's a Canadian.
Superb serve. Awesome serve. Yeah.
But I've never seen him sustain over multiple rounds. But this is a surface which really suits him. He's very accustomed to the conditions. So if he brings his A game over all rounds, I think he could cause an upset or two and go into the second half of the tournament. So that's the rank outsider I'm going to name. So we have not talked. Actually, it's a bit sad. Actually, we have not talked about Rafael Nadal at all.
You know, I was just going to say the same thing. I was just thinking the same.
It's a bit sad, actually, irrespective of whom you support, whom you root for. It's a bit sad that when we are talking about so many names, we don't talk about Rafael Nadal. So, Dan, Rafael Nadal, what's happened to him this year? Is it just sheer wear and tear over all these years, which is catching up?
In the last 2.5 years, we've not seen really the same Rafael Nadal. Occasionally at the French, but not to the level that he's been over the time that I've watched him play. He's got the highest level of endurance I've ever seen in a tennis player. Maybe Djokovic sometimes edges him, but I think over a long period, he's a level of endurance. As he shows on clay every time he plays on it virtually, is phenomenal. His forehand, the whipped forehand, the amount of spin he puts on the ball is something, you know, you rarely see in tennis. The amount of whip he gets on that forehand is incredible. So what's happened? I just think it's injuries. I don't think he's had a variety of injuries, haven't he? And I don't think he's ever got back to what now looks to be his peak. What was his peak fitness when he was really dominating the game between 2008 and 2010. The rivalry he had was with Federer was unbelievable. So, you know, it's a shame, but he's not the same player now, and it's sad to watch.
Do you think that was always on the cards, though, Dan? That because he really uses up a lot of energy with, you know, the way that he plays, and emotionally he puts a lot of effort into his, you know, his game as well. Whereas someone like Federer, he's quite effortless, and you know, you can see how him playing for even a few more years. But do you think a sort of shortish career was always on the cards for Rafa?
Well, absolutely. I remember Sue Barker introducing his first match at Wimbledon, and I think he was 2.5 years younger than what Andy Murray's first match at Wimbledon was. So he's 2.5 years further on in terms of Grand Slams. His strength, like I said, was, you know, that's why he was probably the best we'll ever see on clay. It was just getting to the ball. He could always get to the ball and get it back. And he could do that for longer than you. And although he had a brilliant forehand that worked for him for a couple of years on grass, that was his main skill. His huge amount of power, which is going to cause injuries over a long period of time. And then his endurance levels. So it's going to cost you. And it's especially knees and ankles, which seem to be a lot of the injuries he's had.
I think this slides all over the court actually puts sheer... The amount of stress on his knees and ankles must be insane on clay.
But you see that with Djokovic as well. So do you think he might have similar issues, or does he sort of approach his game a bit differently to Rafa Nadal?
Point, I'm not sure. I think he's a little bit... He kills the points a lot quicker than what Nadal does. So maybe that will have some effect. Or maybe sports science has moved on a little bit since when he started. And I think there's a 4 or 5 year gap between Djokovic's peak and Nadal. So I don't know. It's worth, you know, Djokovic has had a few niggling injuries all season. So it's worth noting.
Because you can see him slip and slide all over the court and, you know, almost doing the splits at some point. And it's amazing to watch. But you do wonder what it's doing to those joints and muscles. So, yeah, I hope, you know, he doesn't have the same issues, because we want to see him for many years to come.
Any of you guys see Nadal making it to the second week?
Hope so. Probably not, though.
Fair point. Clash between the head and the heart, I suppose.
I think we need to... It's hard to conclude a lot in terms of who's going to be playing Djokovic in the final or some of the other semi-final matchups, because we haven't seen a draw yet, have we? You know, they're still doing the qualifiers.
Yep. So.
Well, I'm glad Federer got his number 2 ranking back, so at least that keeps Djokovic absolutely out of the sight until
the That is the biggest final. Disgrace of this podcast. The Andy Murray is world number 2 Andy Murray. Better record than Federer in the last 3 years at Flushing Meadows. Gets favouritism gone mad. I'm going to fume about this on Twitter for hours. Is that allowed? there's very rarely tennis fume, you see, on my timeline.
This is what
That's
you would
the
call
new
just
one, tennis
time.
Fume. Talk I've never seen tennis time. Fume before, sorry. I just had to stop then.
crazy. So any of you watch doubles as well? I'm not sure. I personally do. Any of you watch doubles? If you do, any predictions or any things to watch out for?
I haven't. One thing I've noticed from following Jamie Murray is doubles is unpredictable apart from the Bryant brothers, is it? Bryant brothers?
Yeah.
And the only doubles I ever usually watch, the couple at Grand Slams maybe, but is the Davis Cup. So I don't watch much doubles, but I really enjoy it. I remember watching that battle over being amazing at doubles as well as singles and thinking, yeah, it's a complete tennis player.
It's a shame we don't see any of the... Yeah, I was just going to say, I don't watch too much doubles because, you know, obviously even watching singles takes up a lot of time. But watching with the doubles, I do... It would be nice to see some of the you know, top guys play, that's all. Sometimes, you know, you don't see them. And I think if they played it, then we'd watch a bit more. But I can understand that their schedules just don't allow them to even think about doubles. But it would be nice to see maybe Federer... with playing with Djokovic or something like that, but that's never going to happen, is it?
I think 2 weeks back, Andy Murray actually played. Why I know is Andy Murray was Leander Paes's 101st partner. Imagine 101 different partners.
Wow, that doubles. Sounds wrong.
So he's an absolute legend in terms of doubles, isn't he? And the pair.
Yeah, I think Andy Murray actually Paes and Murray lost to Jamie Murray. I think that week. 2 weeks back.
Yeah, the first time they've ever had a competitive match against each other. And Andy Murray said his inspiration for trying to be that good at tennis was because his brother always beat him. So yep. When they've actually played a game, he beats him as well.
Yeah,
and they won a Wimbledon before him as well.
Yeah, so it was always called the other Murray. So I think it's pretty unfair on Jamie Murray as well. After all, Britain has been craving for some kind of a title there. So I do watch tennis because doubles a lot, because especially the women's doubles, because we have, at least from India, we have Sania Mirza, who is the current world number 1. And They will be the top seeds in US Open, I think. Mirza and Martina Hingis. It's so refreshing to see Martina Hingis play again. I think I enjoyed watching her a lot during her prime career, which unfortunately was cut short. But I think it's great to watch. They are a perfect balance of power and poise, if you could call it. So I think women's doubles, if they actually turn up, I don't think anybody else will win. But it's a question if they turn up.
Is doubles a specialism in India? Can you tell us why there aren't more singles stars, if you want to put it?
I think, one, there's a lack of proper support in the country. So most players tend to favor doubles. One, because they are unable to compete in singles. Pace gave it a proper shot for a while, like the mid-90s. I remember a couple. One was obviously the Olympics in 96. He won the bronze there, I think. Agassi and Bruguera were the other two on the podium. And then he won one in Newport, I think, where he beat Pete Sampras. I think that must be his claim to fame. Irrespective of what he's achieved in doubles, beating Pete Sampras in singles is definitely something you would brag about after the end of your career. Though I don't know when his career will end. He's already 40 and he wants to play in Rio Olympics. So I don't think his career is... We should not be even...
The development of younger Indian singles players then, there, is it?
Yeah, there are just a couple of them, but most seemingly prefer doubles. Maybe I think they recognize early that they don't have the skill set to survive in singles. So we have couple of decent double players now. Pace is one. We had Bopanna, who was playing doubles, who's still playing doubles. But I think now the recently Mirza's stock is at her all-time high, world number one top seed. She's just been awarded the highest sporting award of the country, the Khel Ratna Award. She's been nominated for that this year for her performance throughout the year. So I think her stock is at an all-time high. So I think if they do turn up, I think they'll easily win the doubles. If they don't, then as with doubles, as you said, we do. The Bryan brothers have also started dipping. I think their career is also on the wane. It's not about not winning. They are losing far more often and far more easily than what they are used to. So I think the Bryan brothers aren't whom you would call favorites anymore, and I think that's a bit sad. I think they are the three top doubles pairs I've seen, at least. Them, the Woodies, and Pace and Bhupathi in their short-lived prime were the three best pairs I've seen. So it's a shame, though.
Good knowledge.
I tend to watch doubles a bit more, though. So that's about it. So any early round upsets you think might happen? Any players who you think are vulnerable to early round shocks? I know anybody is on their day, but any names you think would be prime candidates?
I think it's impossible to say because the draw has not been done, and until you see who they're playing, it's hard to call whether they're likely to be an upset. I tried to figure it out, but other than Nadal, who might just be injured, I don't know.
I think in the women's side, I think someone who would call as a dangerous floater now is Ivanovic. You don't know what's going to happen. She's going to cause upsets, or she's just going to get knocked. She's a dangerous floater. He used this term a lot in cricket, a dangerous floater. So she's someone whom you wouldn't want to face in early rounds if you're the top players. She's just making a comeback, but with her, you don't know as usual. It's a bit like Kvitova, as we talked before. You don't know what you're going to get from her. Umara, any names?
Like Dan said, it's a bit difficult. With Ivanovic, she's seeded 7, so I think she probably won't meet any of the top players later on. But it's difficult to say, really. I mean, in the women, anything's possible. Serena could go out in the first round. You never know on her day. It's happened before. Unlikely, but, you know, it's just that unpredictable. So not really any big shocks. Sharapova, like we said, if she does come, I mean, she's scheduled to play in the US Open. We haven't heard anything different, but she was injured last week. So she's another one that could be upset. But, you know, she does tend to sort of turn it around when the big tournaments come around. But yeah, I think pretty much looking at your top guys getting where they should
be.
I'd love to see Azarenka do well, because she's number 20 at the moment, which is ridiculous. And she was injured last year, so she needs to work her way back up. So she could meet somebody early on, which would be an interesting couple of rounds there.
I want to see what happens to Wozniacki after all this huge noise.
It's forcing it to play at Flushing Meadows there.
This 2,000 points now we are talking about, let alone 900, which was what Toronto was worth. We are talking 2,000.
I'd love
2000.
Her to win. I'd love her to do well. She's a Liverpool fan, so there you go.
Yeah, loyalty is in its proper place.
Yeah, but to be honest, she hasn't really got the game, I don't think, to win a Grand Slam. Not to beat those top girls anyway.
She certainly hasn't got the mentality.
But
she's worked a huge lot on her fitness, though. She's taken to running marathons and all.
I don't think her fitness endurance was ever an issue. I think it's just sometimes her range of shots. She doesn't really get much power on it.
She's talked about how running has actually helped her clear up mentally and in terms of fatigue levels, mental fatigue. Mm. She attributes more physical fitness helping her mental fatigue levels also. But as you said, her all-round game isn't that much in-depth to get to the later rounds, I think.
She had that quite a long, over a year, where she was world number one and didn't really win. She won Masters, the 1,000 events, but not any Grand Slams. And have that horrible tag of being the slamless number one.
That's been a common theme in women's tennis, though. A lot of players rising to number one without actually winning majors. Been happening over the last few years.
Are we going to do a massive in-depth review of the US Open once it's finished?
Sure.
Only if Federer wins.
You can't back out now.
We want a Federer Djokovic final.
Otherwise, you can just come in every 1 minute and say, I'm still sad, I'm still seething, I'm still confused, and do that every 1 minute.
I'll have loads of stats for you, don't you worry.
Oh, yeah, I'll definitely look forward to that.
Then our duties are very much lesser now than Umara. We can say, we present our guest, Dan. Okay, thank you, bye.
We won't have to say anything. Yeah, we'll just leave him to it for an hour.
it will be perfect, like Djokovic. He can just keep going. Dan, how much ever you want, Dan can supply you the numbers, can supply you the. So that's going to be great. So Dan, before we close, any particular plugs you want to put in here? Since it's our first show, anything tennis related or non tennis related, anything?
Well, we're gonna have the cricket info podcast, which we're recording tomorrow night, for anyone who wants to listen. And
is it a celebration part?
Well, kind of, but we lost the last test, so we'll see. And there's the Aussie on there, Alex from AI, so he'll be on.
Dead rubber.
Exactly. Yeah. And hopefully a TTT tactics podcast soon. Within the next week or so. So that should be good.
Can't wait for that. Love those.
Umara, anything to plug?
I'm not going to plug anything AI because you all do that anyway. So I'll just, Dan's not going to like this one, but I'll do it anyway. RogerFedererFans.com. I write for them sometimes. so a really good website if you're a Federer fan. If you're a Djokovic or a Nadal fan, can't help you there. Sorry.
You need an auto reader.
You can speak to Dan on Twitter. And what is it? Analyze Sports?
Yeah, that's Analyze Sports.
I'll direct you there.
Not if you're a Federer fan. I'll decline the request.
Don't make me block you, Dan.
So nothing much to plug. I think the only thing I would plug is the writer show. They have a special fantasy football show every week, covering each week of the fantasy football show. So if any of you are fans of it, do give it a listen. So that's a wrap, man. Hope you enjoyed it as much as we did on the show. Thank you and keep listening.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.